Chapter 43. Jorgensen, standing by the taffrail, noted the faint reddish glow in the massive blackness of the further shore. Jorgensen noted things quickly, cursorily, perfunctorily, as phenomenon related to his own apparitional existence of a visiting ghost. They were but passages in the game of men who were still playing at life. He knew too well how much that game was worth to be concerned about its course. He had given up the habit of thinking for so long that the sudden resumption of it irked him exceedingly, especially as he had to think on toward a conclusion. And that world of eternal oblivion, of which he had tasted before lingered made him step back into the life of men. All things were settled once for all. He was irritated by his own perplexity, which was like a reminder of that mortality made up of questions and passions from which he had fancied he had freed himself forever. By a natural association, his contemptuous annoyance embraced the existence of Mrs. Travers too, for how could he think of Tom Lingard, of what was good or bad for King Tom, without thinking also of that woman who had managed to put the ghost of a spark even into his own extinguished eyes? She was of no account, but Tom's integrity was. It was of Tom that he had to think, of what was good or bad for Tom in that absurd and deadly game of his life. Finally he reached the conclusion that to be given the ring would be good for Tom Lingard. Just to be given the ring and no more. The ring and no more. It will help him to make up his mind, muttered Jorgensen in his mustache, as if compelled by an obscure conviction. It was only then that he stirred slightly and turned away from the loom of the fires on the distant shore. Mrs. Travers heard his footsteps passing again along the side of the deckhouse, and this time never raised her head. That man was sleepless, mad, childish, and inflexible. He was impossible. He haunted the decks of that hull gamelessly. It was, however, in pursuance of a very distinct aim that Jorgensen had gone forward again to seek Jaffer. The first remark he had to offer to Jaffer's consideration was that the only person in the world who had the remotest chance of reaching Bellarope's gate on that night was that tall white woman the Rajalot had brought on board, the wife of one of the captive white chiefs. Surprise made Jaffer exclaim, but he wasn't prepared to deny that. It was possible that for many reasons, some quite simple, and others very subtle, those sons of the evil one belonging to Tenga and Damon would refrain from killing a white woman walking alone from the water's edge to Bellarope's gate. Yes, it was just possible that she might walk unharmed. Especially if she carried a blazing torch, muttered Jorgensen in his mustache. He told Jaffer that she was sitting now in the dark, mourning silently in the manner of white women. As he had made a great outcry in the morning to be allowed to join the white men on shore. He, Jorgensen, had refused her the canoe. Ever since as he had secluded herself in the deckhouse in great distress. Jaffer listened to it all without particular sympathy. And when Jorgensen added, "It is in my mind, oh Jaffer, to let her have her will now," he answered by A.S., "by Allah, let her go. What does it matter?" Of the greatest unconcern, till Jorgensen added, "Yes, and she may carry the ring to the Rajalot." Jorgensen saw Jaffer, the grim and impassive Jaffer, give a perceptible start. It seemed at first an impossible task to persuade Jaffer to part with the ring. The notion was too monstrous to enter his mind, to move his heart. But at last he surrendered in an awed whisper, "God is great. Perhaps it is her destiny." Being a Wajo man, he did not regard women as untrustworthy or unequal to a task requiring courage and judgment. Once he got over the personal feeling, he handed the ring to Jorgensen with only one reservation, "You know, Tuan, that she must on no account put it on her finger." "Let her hang it round her neck," suggested Jorgensen, readily. As Jorgensen moved toward the deckhouse, it occurred to him that perhaps now that woman Tom Lingard had taken in tow might take it into her head to refuse to leave the Emma. This did not disturb him very much. All those people moved in the dark. He himself at that particular moment was moving in the dark. Beyond the simple wish to guide Lingard's thought in the direction of Asim and Amada, to help him to make up his mind at last to a ruthless fidelity to his purpose, Jorgensen had no other aim. The existence of those whites had no meaning on Earth. They were the sort of people that pass without leaving footprints. That woman would have to act in ignorance. And if she refused to go, then in ignorance she would have to stay on board. He would tell her nothing. As a matter of fact, he discovered that Mrs. Travers would simply have nothing to do with him. She would not listen to what he had to say. She desired him, a mere weary voice confined in the darkness of the deck cabin, to go away and trouble her no more. But the ghost of Jorgensen was not easily exorcised. He, too, was a mere voice in the outer darkness, inexorable, insisting that she should come out on deck and listen. At last he found the right words to say. "It is something about Tom that I want to tell you. You wish him well, don't you?" After this she could not refuse to come out on deck, and once there she listened patiently to that white ghost muttering and mumbling above her drooping head. "It seems to me, Captain Jorgensen," she said after he had ceased, "that you are simply trifling with me. After your behavior to me this morning, I can have nothing to say to you." "I have a canoe for you now," mumbled Jorgensen. "You have some new purpose in view now," retorted Mrs. Travers with spirit. "But you won't make it clear to me. What is it that you have in your mind?" "Tom's interest." "Are you really his friend?" "He brought me here. You know it. He has talked a lot to you." "He did. But I ask myself whether you are capable of being anybody's friend." "You ask yourself," repeated Jorgensen, very quiet and morose. "If I am not his friend, I should like to know who is." Mrs. Travers asked, quickly, "Colin, what's all this about a ring?" "What ring?" "Tom's property. He has had it for years." "And he gave it to you? Doesn't he care for it?" "Don't know. It's just a thing. But it has a meaning, as between you and him." "Is that so?" "Yes. It has. He will know what it means." "What does it mean?" "I am too much his friend not to hold my tongue." "What? To me? And who are you?" was Jorgensen's unexpected remark. "He has told you too much already." "Perhaps he has," whispered Mrs. Travers, as if to herself. "And you want that ring to be taken to him?" she asked, in a louder tone. "Yes. At once. For his good." "Are you certain it is for his good? Why can't you?" Dot, she checked herself. That man was hopeless. He would never tell anything, and there was no means of compelling him. He was invulnerable, unapproachable. He was dead. "Just give it to him," mumbled Jorgensen, as though pursuing a mere fixed idea. "Jay, just slip it quietly into his hand. He will understand." "What is it? Advice, warning, signal for action?" "It may be anything," uttered Jorgensen, morosely, but as it were in a mollified tone. "It's meant for his good." "Oh, if I only could trust that man," mused Mrs. Travers, half aloud. Jorgensen's slight noise in the throat might have been taken for an expression of sympathy. But he remained silent. "Really, this is most extraordinary," cried Mrs. Travers, suddenly aroused. "Why did you come to me? Why should it be my task? Why should you want me specially to take it to him?" "I will tell you why," said Jorgensen's blank voice. "It's because there is no one on board this hulk that can hope to get alive inside that stockade. This morning you told me yourself that you were ready to die for Tom or with Tom. Well, risk it then. You are the only one that has half a chance to get through, and Tom, maybe, is waiting." "The only one," repeated Mrs. Travers with an abrupt movement forward and an extended hand before which Jorgensen stepped back a pace. "I'll risk it. Certainly. Where's that mysterious ring?" "I have got it in my pocket," said Jorgensen, readily, Yet nearly half a minute elapsed before Mrs. Travers felt the characteristic shape being pressed into her half-open palm. D, don't let anybody see it, Jorgensen admonished her in a murmur. H, hide it somewhere about you. Why not hang it round your neck? Mrs. Travers' hand remained firmly closed on the ring. Why, yes, that will do, she murmured, hastily. I'll be back in a moment. Get everything ready. With those words she disappeared inside the deckhouse, and presently threads of light appeared in the interstices of the boards. Mrs. Travers had lighted a candle in there. She was busy hanging that ring round her neck. She was going. Yes, taking the risk for Tom's sake. Nobody can resist that man, Jorgensen muttered to himself with increasing moroseness. I couldn't. I.V. Jorgensen, after seeing the canoe leave the ship's side, ceased to live intellectually. There was no need for more thinking, for any display of mental ingenuity. He had done with it all. All his notions were perfectly fixed, and he could go over them in the same ghostly way in which he haunted the deck of the Emma. At the sight of the ring, Lingard would return to Assam and Amata, now captives too, though Jorgensen certainly did not think them in any serious danger. What had happened really was that Tenga was now holding hostages, and those Jorgensen looked upon as Lingard's own people. They were his. He had gone in with them deep, very deep. They had a hold and a claim on King Tom just as many years ago people of that very race had a hold and a claim on him, Jorgensen. Only Tom was a much bigger man. A very big man. Nevertheless, Jorgensen didn't see why he should escape his own fate, Jorgensen's fate to be absorbed, captured, made their own either in failure or in success. It was an unavoidable fatality and Jorgensen felt certain that the ring would compel Lingard to face it without flinching. What he really wanted Lingard to do was to cease to take the slightest interest in those whites who were the sort of people that left no footprints. Perhaps at first sight, sending that woman to Lingard was not the best way toward that end. Jorgensen, however, had a distinct impression in which his morning talk with Mrs. Travers had only confirmed him that those two had quarreled for good. As, indeed, was unavoidable. What did Tom Lingard want with any woman? The only woman in Jorgensen's life had come in by way of exchange for a lot of cotton stuffs and several brass guns. This fact could not, but affect Jorgensen's judgment since obviously in this case such a transaction was impossible. Therefore the case was not serious. It didn't exist. What did exist, was Lingard's relation to the Wajo exiles, a great and warlike adventure such as no rover in those seas had ever attempted. That Tenga was much more ready to negotiate than to fight, the old adventurer had not the slightest doubt. How Lingard would deal with him was not a concern of Jorgensen's. That would be easy enough. Nothing prevented Lingard from going to see Tenga and talking to him with authority. All that ambitious person really wanted was to have a share in Lingard's wealth, in Lingard's power, in Lingard's friendship. A year before, Tenga had once insinuated to Jorgensen, in what way am I less worthy of being a friend than Belarab? It was a distinct overture, a disclosure of the man's innermost mind. Jorgensen, of course, had met it with a profound silence. His task was not diplomacy, but the care of stores. After the effort of connected mental processes in order to bring about Mrs. Travers' departure, he was anxious to dismiss the whole matter from his mind. The last thought he gave to it was severely practical. It occurred to him that it would be advisable to attract in some way or other Lingard's attention to the lagoon. In the language of the sea, a single rocket is properly a signal of distress, but, in the circumstances, a group of three sent up simultaneously would convey a warning. He gave his orders and watched the rockets go up finally with a trail of red sparks, a bursting of white stars high up in the air, and three loud reports in quick succession. Then he resumed his pacing of the whole length of the hulk, confident that after this Tom would guess that something was up and set a close watch over the lagoon. No doubt these mysterious rockets would have a disturbing effect on Tenga and his friends and cause a great excitement in the settlement. But for that, Jorgensen did not care. The settlement was already in such a turmoil that a little more excitement did not matter. What Jorgensen did not expect, however, was the sound of a musket shot fired from the jungle facing the bows of the Emma. It caused him to stop dead short. He had heard distinctly the bullet strike the curve of the bow forward. "Some hot-headed ass fired that," he said to himself, contemptuously. It simply disclosed to him the fact that he was already besieged on the shore side and set at rest his doubts as to the length Tenga was prepared to go. Any length. Of course there was still time for Tom to put everything right with six words, unless... Jorgensen smiled, grimly, in the dark, and resumed his tireless pacing. What amused him was to observe the fire which had been burning night and day before Tenga's residence suddenly extinguished. He pictured to himself the wild rush with bamboo buckets to the lagoon shore, the confusion, the hurry and jostling in a great hissing of water midst clouds of steam. The image of the fat Tenga's consternation appealed to Jorgensen's sense of humor for about 5 seconds. Then he took up the binoculars from the roof of the deckhouse. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.